The idea of a dialogue between Buddhist thought and Western science has been around for some time now, in part as a result of the work of the Mind and Life Institute under the patronage of His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which is an organisation with which this School of Religious Studies has incidentally had quite a close connection to the central role of another of its members, Professor Thubten Jinpa. I think that's perhaps worth mentioning in this contemplative science context, because the Mind and Life Institute has been one of the major forces behind the development of what could be called the contemplative science agenda. Another factor behind contemplative science has been, the so-called mindfulness movement, which has involved the widespread incorporation of techniques derived from Buddhist meditation practices within Western psychiatry and increasingly within many other contexts in Western and global societies. From the point of view of religious studies, this is also a significant development in that it marks a real shift in the nature of the encounter between scientific and religious forms of knowledge, particularly in relation to Asian religions. There's a long history to this encounter, going back at least to the debates between Buddhists and missionaries in late 19th century Sri Lanka, and to the presence of Asian religions at the World Parliament of Religions in Chicago in 1893, and in some ways long before that to earlier connections such as the influence of Chinese philosophical concepts on Leibniz in the early 17th century and all sorts of other connections. There's more, if you dig through the historical record, than you realise, quite a lot more. But it is arguable that we're now in a new phase, one that's much closer to a dialogue between equal partners than most of what's taken place in the past, and which is founded in a much more sophisticated knowledge of the other partner on both sides. This paper is really an attempt to close in on some of the key issues in this dialogue through looking at a specific example. And the question I'll be looking at is the relationship between a set of Tibetan ideas, the unbalanced flows in the subtle body of my title, that could be taken as a Tibetan Buddhist theory of mental illness, which of course is a Western term, and Western ideas of the autonomic nervous system and its role in relation to psychiatric disorders. And I talk rather equivalently and loosely of psychiatric disorders and mental illness in the course of this paper, I should say. I'm not intending a strong distinction between them of any kind. There seems a parallel between these sets of ideas, as you'll see, and I'll try to spell that out in the paper. But they're also based in two quite specific traditions of knowledge, each of which presupposes a different set of assumptions about the nature of the world and human beings. So I want to talk about Tibetan ideas of the subtle body and its role in psychiatric illness, then more briefly about Western ideas of the role of the autonomic nervous system in relation to psychiatric disorders, and then look at what happens if we try to bring them together in the last section. Now, this involves much discussion of issues in relation to which I have limited expertise, so I apologise in advance, especially to those of you from the psychiatry side of things, for anything I say that's particularly stupid or off the wall. There's bound to be a few things, so be prepared. I think, however, that this is intrinsic to the situation. Any genuine dialogue is going to involve exploring things that some of the partners are not very well informed about on both sides. This is inevitably an exploratory process. We need to find out more about these things as we go along, and that's just how it is. Giving this paper is one way to find out what I don't know, so please feel free to tell me. And I might also say that it's necessary to simplify a bit if we're to proceed here. In reality, of course, there's no such unified thing as Western science. There's a whole series of projects with lots of differences between them, and often quite radically different understandings of what they're doing. Nor really is there a unified Tibetan Buddhist understanding of, say, the channels and chakras of the subtle body. There's a variety of traditions and a variety of ways of understanding them within those traditions. So in a way, I'm presenting an oversimplified Tibetan Buddhist here, speaking to an equally somewhat caricatured Western scientist, both impersonated by an anthropologist, who, for perhaps at his age, should know better than he was. Okay, so the main topic of this section of the lecture is illness caused by disorders in this term this Tibetan term, which is pronounced lung, most often rendered in English as wind, but as you'll see, that's a somewhat limited translation. Now, illnesses of this kind, lung-related illnesses, do not include the entire range of what might in Western terms be described as mental disorders or psychiatric illness, but they include a substantial part of it, particularly areas that we might describe in terms of depression or anxiety. And lung is undoubtedly one of the primary ways in which what we would term mental disorders are understood by Tibetans. Others include the action of spirits and deities and the consequences of one's own actions in previous lives, in other words, the effects of karma, and these may come up a little bit as we go along or in the discussion. For contemporary Tibetans, these, along with borrowings from Western psychiatric vocabularies, are all part of how they're making sense of the situation. They're not so much alternative kinds of illness as alternative modes of explanation. There's certainly some kinds of illness are more likely to be explained and approached in one way than another. Now, Tibetan medical tradition, which dates in its mature form to the 12th century, when the canonical medical text, the Gyushi, or four medical tantras, came into being, integrates elements from the various major Asian medical traditions of the time. It's a modern Tibetan block print of the four tantras. Just to give you a quick idea, I mean, at the time that Tibetan medicine came into formation, there were at least generally described as three major medical, pre-modern medical traditions in Asia, the Greek-Persian tradition, going back initially to Hippocrates and Galen and so on, and also present in India under the name Unani, which means Greek, the Indian tradition of Ayurveda and Chinese medicine, and lots of sub-disciplines coming out of these. But all three of these have some impact on Tibetan medicine historically, but the theoretical and conceptual structure of Tibetan medicine is mainly based on the Indian tradition of Ayurveda, which is why that's bolded there. The term lung translates the Sanskrit term vata, which is the standard term for one of the three doshas, or pathogenic factors within the Ayurvedic medical tradition, and some of you may know a little about Ayurveda already. The three doshas and their Tibetan equivalents are usually translated in the Tibetan equivalents are called Nyepa and Y-E-S-P-A, are usually translated into English as wind, bile, and phlegm. So rather than referring to these substances within the body, they actually function as labels for more complex internal processes, and it really makes more sense to keep the original terms both in the Ayurvedic and in the West, in the Tibetan context. Both the dosha and the nyepa, the Ayurvedic and the Tibetan terms, are sometimes translated as humours, which is a term that goes back to the old European system of humoral medicine, which of course then became the Arabic and Persian tradition and had its own influence on Tibet. But the term humour is actually problematic in this context, particularly, I think, for the Tibetans. And they're perhaps better rendered as pathogenic or illness-causing factors. Other authors have used different translations. Chicago and Brendan Azawa de Silva talk about psychophysical energies, which I find maybe says something. At least it stresses that this is something that has a psycho as well as a physical component. We'll come back to that. But before looking in detail at how lung functions within Tibetan medicine, there are two important points to be made. One is that while Tibetan medicine is related to Ayurveda and includes substantial borrowings from it, both in terms of theory and practice, it's by no means identical. One key difference is that while the three dosha in Ayurveda are treated more or less as organic or physiological processes within the human body, the main Tibetan treatise, the medical treatise, the Gyushi, which you just saw the picture of, adds an additional level of explanation, which is that the dosha or nyepa are seen as themselves caused by factors that operate at the level of consciousness. So instead of just having these things that are happening within the body, they're seen as somehow caused. And exactly what cause means here is complicated by these factors called the three poisons, three root klesha, nyunmung in Tibetan, desire, hatred, and delusion. Now these are basically the roots of samsara. They're the things that keep the whole process of the everyday world going, which means in Tibetan Buddhist terms they're essentially not a good thing. But what's also, I think, important is that this gives mind, consciousness, and something that you might or might not refer to as emotional states, and quite whether you want to call desire and hatred emotions. Some people do, as you'll see. But nevertheless, these have a causal role in relation to all kinds of physical and mental disease. So this shifts Tibetan medicine in a way away from the organic, or at least it gives it a whole other level of explanation. How far individual Tibetan doctors stress that, how far they look at the more organic and physiological level varies, but the potential is at least there. And another second issue brings the question of consciousness into Tibetan medicine in a somewhat different way. This Tibetan term lung, as I said, translates one of the three dosha. It doesn't only translate one of the three dosha. It also translates another important Sanskrit term, which is prana. Now, prana is often rendered in English as breath, but it refers not just to the process of respiration, but to a variety of subtle inner flows within the body. Ideas about the flow of prana within the body go back in India to the early Upanishads, dating perhaps to the 5th or 4th century BCE, but they were developed much further in the context of the growth of tantric yogic practices in Indian religions from the 8th century CE onwards. So they became an important part of tantric ideas about the so-called subtle body. And they were transmitted to Tibet along with Buddhist versions of tantric yoga. Now, in tantric theory, prana, or lung, is seen as intimately involved with consciousness. To cite a widely used image, prana is the horse on which mind rides. There's this idea that mind can only go where the horse goes, but the horse is also, the mind is also guiding the horse. There's a kind of mutual relationship. Chikako and Brendan Azar de Silva, who I just mentioned, argued some years ago, this linkage is really at the centre of the Tibetan understanding of the relationship between mind and body. At the gross levels of everyday experience, they differ, but the closer, the more subtle the level that you look at them, the closer they get to each other, until you get to this point where they're virtually two sides of the same coin. Yogic or meditational practices involving the manipulation and transformation of these internal flows, so-called salung practices, became and remain a key part of the yogic techniques employed by Buddhist tantric practitioners in Tibet. And they're thought to provide training in controlling the flow of lung within the subtle body, which is a very important thing to learn to do if you're a Tibetan yogic practitioner, because it gives you access to the subtle levels of consciousness which are essential for the attainment of Buddhahood. Now, the fact that lung in Tibetan has this dual derivation from the Ayurvedic literature, where it translates a term referring to a pathogenic factor in the body, which has a wind or air-like quality, and from the Buddhist tantric literature of India, where it translates another different term referring to inner flows in the subtle body, isn't all that unusual. Sanskrit has a much larger vocabulary than Tibetan. Different Sanskrit terms are often translated by the same word in Tibetan. But in this case, it's arguably led to a conflation and mutual influence between the two terms in Tibetan thought. Tibetan scholars were well aware that lung figures in distinct ways in these two different literatures, but using the same term at least set the stage for a productive encounter between them. And this was particularly true because meditation, especially tantric meditation, was already seen in Tibet, as elsewhere, as an activity that could indeed lead to states of imbalanced lung, that in Western terms would probably be classified as psychiatric disorders. And thus, lung-derived illness was a question of direct concern already for tantric practitioners. So you get this kind of overlap in both areas between consciousness and the material and physiological level, which I think also builds a much stronger and more direct role for mind and consciousness in Tibetan medicine than can be found within Ayurveda or arguably within Western medicine. And this is certainly one of the things that have led people to find Tibetan medicine interesting and attractive and worth investigating. So the Tibetan medical analysis of lung illness is in large part based not on Ayurvedic ideas about vata, as is true for a lot of other Tibetan medical understandings, but on yogic and tantric ideas about prana. And in particular, the old scheme of the five main prana flows, or prana vayu, within the body, has been adapted to provide a kind of classification and analysis of psychiatric disorders. You're not getting a suboptimal experience there, but there were a few references. there are the five lung, which are a bit shaky today, so there you are. These main flows of prana, or wind, lung, wind, are found within the yogic system in India, and they're also referred to in some Ayurvedic texts, and they have various functions within the body. They're quite significant within this lecture, so I'm going to spend a little time on them. And here just is a list of them with the one set of conventional English translations, actually, from Barry Clark, and the Tibetan and Sanskrit equivalents. So these are five processes within the mind-body, whatever, subtle body. And this is actually a passage from the Kyushi, from the Tibetan medical classic. It's a bit condensed compared to some other descriptions, but it gives you the general idea. And you can see that it goes through the five lung one by one. It gives for each one a location within the body. It talks about how it travels through the body, how it moves around in the body, and it talks about what it does. Barry's translation is maybe a little bit medicalized in places, and there are different ways you could translate some of this, but anyway. And here you can see, here are the first three, and the life-sustaining lung and the pervading lung are actually particularly going to involve us later on. And here are two more with a picture of the cover of Barry's book, which is actually a translation of the first two of the four medical tantras. So here we have these five things, energies, things moving through the body, which are carrying out various functions. I think the idea of what the lung are is worth holding on to a bit there. Now, imbalances or disorders in these five lung can have physiological effects, but they can also manifest as what we would call mental disorders. And I'll move on to give some examples shortly. At any rate, lung disorders are an important class of illnesses within Tibetan medical understandings. And I think they're of interest for our purposes for a variety of reasons. And these, just to give you a quick sense of why we might be interested in lung, the first, I think, is the extensive overlap with the Western category of psychiatric disorders. The second is that this isn't actually just a Tibetan issue. You'll find things like lung in quite a few other traditions, particularly Chinese, where qi, feng, xie all have this sort of nature and there's literatures about them as things that seem to relate to medical disorders and particularly psychiatric type disorders. And really the final point here, which is more what this lecture is heading towards, that one can take the relationship between this explanatory framework in terms of lung disorders and the explanatory framework of Western neurology as paradigmatic in some ways for the relationship between Tibetan and Western thought about mind and consciousness. At least that's what I'm going to try to do. Okay. So, lung disorders in Tibetan medicine. As I said, disturbances of the lung can often take a psychological form. This is the contemporary Tibetan Dr. Pasang Arya discussing disturbances of the Sogzin lung, which is the first of the lung, the life-sustaining lung. And as you can see, if life-sustaining lung functions, so this is a contemporary Tibetan doctor actually writing on his website for a Western audience, I should say, but it's nevertheless, I think, quite accurate to aspects of the Tibetan tradition. If life-sustaining lung functions become distorted or disturbed, one may lose consciousness and balance, manifest vertigo, lose constant control of the body-mind, have wrong perceptions, confusion, hear sounds in the head and ears, experience feelings of head emptiness, have hallucinations, and then you get a series of somewhat more physiological things ending up, could even become the cause of madness. And this is the category of illnesses that's generally known as Soglung, which is an abbreviation, Sogzin, lung. And as you can see, it involves both physiological and psychological effects. Another very important lung, from our point of view, is the pervading wind, Chabje lung, and this is associated with the heart. So it manifests as this disease, illness category called Ning lung, heart wind. And here is some Pasang Arya's description. Problems with Ninglung manifest in loss of balance, hypertension, chest tension, fear, panic attacks, fainting, loss of speech, general cardiac disorders, talkativeness, the desire to roam, and so on and so on. Along with blood circulation disorders, pains in the joints, heart palpitations, and so on. So, later I'm going to consider briefly case studies of a few case studies of some of these things. Now, there's been a fair amount of attention to lung disorders, and there are three other lung also, there are things that can go wrong with them. There's been a fair amount of attention to lung disorders in Western language writing on Tibetan medicine. Craig James, an American medical anthropologist who carried out research on Tibetan medical practice in central Tibet in the late 1980s and early 1990s, comments as follows. In Buddhist medical theory, lung imbalance is linked most closely to the mental poison of desire, and this is back to this whole idea of the relationship between the poisons and the nepa. And he talks about how physicians in central Tibet use this operationally, and talk about how desire could manifest among average people and lead to an imbalance of lung. People want to have good living conditions, enough food, obedient children, peace in the family. When they don't have these things, it leads to mental agitations, and these in turn cause lung imbalance. Another American medical anthropologist, Eric Jacobson, worked with Tibetans in India a little later on. In an article from 2007, he notes that lung is often used by lay Tibetans as well as medical practitioners in ways that parallel the use of stress in contemporary Western discourse. I have wind today, or he has wind, generally indicates a temporary condition of moderate irritability or emotional lability due to some adverse circumstance, and so on. There's a distinct similarity between the Tibetan lay explanatory use of wind and Western lay invocation to stress and trauma to explain states of emotional or cognitive disturbance and even of illness. We'll return momentarily to stress later in the lecture, but anyway. Much of Jacobson's work is concerned with locating Western psychiatric equivalents for Tibetan cases of lung, and specifically Soglung, which he constituted six of his 16 case studies. So he checks the symptoms of his six Soglung cases in detail against what was then the fourth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, and tells us that five of the six cases qualified for both major depression and general anxiety disorder, or missed full comorbidity by only a single criterion symptom. None of the six closely approached qualifying for any other DSM-4 diagnosis. And so he's very concerned with trying to map it on to Western psychiatric categories. And I think the possibility of this kind of mapping across systems is of some interest, but it's rather separate from the issue I'm dealing with in this paper. I'll now move on to look at some case studies briefly. So this is one from the early 20th century. It's from a translation of a book by a well-known contemporary Tibetan Lama, Namgyel Norbu Rinpoche. It's a biography of one of his uncles, in fact, a Tibetan yogic practitioner named Ogyen Tenzin, who's regarded as having achieved the state of rainbow body. Some of you may know this. It involves dissolving your body into the elements, so you don't leave a physical body behind at the end of your life. And it's a very rare occasion. There are a number of instances that are supposed to have happened in recent times, but it's regarded as a sign of very high yogic attainment. But the early chapters of the book discuss his childhood experience of lung illness, and he had a rather difficult childhood. He went off to study at this monastery with his uncle. The uncle died. The people at the monastery treated him really badly. He ran off back home. He was given a job as a servant to a local aristocrat. Somebody in the household stole the cup, and he got accused of having taken it. And then he fell ill with lung disorder. It turned out that evidence came up that he hadn't taken the cup, but the disorder continued. Things got worse. His mother fell ill. He nursed her for some months, but she died. And then he completely went into the disorder. His family locked him up in a room, and it was only some 6 years later he was taken to see a distinguished Lama, Ajahn Drupa Rinpoche, who performed various rituals, and at that point he recovered, and in fact became a yogic practitioner. Ajahn Drupa sent him off to become a yogi, and this was the start of his yogic career. It's quite an interesting story. It has some similarities to the story of shamanic illness, actually, which is very common in many cultures, as many of you will know. But this is a more contemporary story. This is from, and that was Ninglu, the one that seems to be closest to the sort of depression anxiety area. This is again Ninglu. It's an instance from Craig James, who I mentioned before. And this is a woman who's in the Tibet Autonomous Region, so in Chinese-controlled Tibet, and she's a government official, and she's in quite a difficult situation. She's in an office that sets commodity prices, and as you can imagine, people in the Tibetan population are not happy about this office. You know, this is, in fact, it's subject to some loathing, he says. She's anxious and agitated. She launches into a rapidly spoken litany of complaints, underscored by strong emotion. She's dizzy, her head aches almost constantly. She's frightened by her heart, which feels as if it's swinging wildly in her chest. She has trouble sleeping. She dreams of her father who died before. Her job causes her much worry and anxiety. The doctor says, "You've got Ninglung. This is really serious. You need to be hospitalized. As long as you keep working, your problem will continue." This is actually quite interesting. In that James implies in his article that Tibetan doctors at that time were systematically using lung diagnoses as a way to relieve their patients from the stresses of the Chinese occupation. So what this was actually doing at one level was taking this person away from the job and saying, "You go off and we'll look after you somewhere for a few months until you get over it." Which, anyway. Here's another example of lung illness. This one is Chaglung, a mixture of Soglung and Chaglung. It's from Eric Jacobson. This is a Tibetan woman in her 70s. She's a refugee in India, and she's living with her two daughters and grandchildren in a tiny hut in a small neighbourhood of similar dwellings with other Tibetan refugees. She, again, has got a really difficult story. She's back in Tibet. Her husband's trading stock had been taken by Chinese troops. They were then forced to leave as refugees. They lost a lot of their resources in the process. Two of her children died, then her husband died, and she was left to raise the surviving children on her own. And according to Jacobson, she had a mixture of depression and anxiety symptoms, along with various somatic issues, including problems with her legs and nosebleeds. Yeah, there's a bit more about her there, and her symptoms, anxiety, feeling her heartbeat, which we had with the previous one too, the sensation of a rope around her neck, severe headaches, trouble walking, and so on. And she also had the nosebleeds, are typical of episodes of blood wind, which, now, tracked blood is not technically one of the three nyepa, but it has a similar kind of status within Tibetan medicine. And in modern times, it tends to get assimilated to questions of high blood pressure. But Chaglung, combination of blood being heated, high blood pressure, quote marks, and wind disorders is another very frequently recognized Lung syndrome, if you like. Obviously, this fits in with Jacobson's line of mixture of generalized anxiety disorder and major depression in DSM-4, and in a way that's where he's heading for in the longer thing that this comes from. But it gives you, again, a bit of an idea of what these things manifest as. And finally, another example, which maybe is a little bit more light-hearted, I don't know, one from Audrey Prost, who was an important refugee monk in Dharamsala. So this is a guy who's quite high up in the Dharamsala administration. He's had a particularly successful ascent in the hierarchy. He completed Geshe training when he was quite young. He travelled widely as a member of the Dalai Lama's private office. A number of friends referred to him as a Michenpo. He's an important person. And like many monks, he suffers from high blood pressure and has been told by both biomedical and traditional doctors to be mindful of his diet. And he finally asked the advice of an elderly and experienced Tibetan doctor, the Mensikang, is a medical institute in Dharamsala, who diagnoses him with a potentially dangerous form of lung imbalance. And then says, well, what you really need is the golden needle treatment, golden needle moxibustion. But he's quite scared about this. It's not a particularly... That's somebody having... It involves needles being attached with incense burning on them. And this can deal with your lung, but he decides he's not going to do this. He'll just go on with his pills. And the doctor comments slightly sarcastically that it's really his busy lifestyle and rich diet and high level of intellectual activity, not a good thing, which causes this imbalance. And behind this, Audrey comments, lurks a slight reproof of the Geshe's quick social ascent in the exile religious hierarchy. So you can see lung being used in a variety of ways here. And I might just add that the implicit criticism there is also, might also be found in a common Tibetan view that Westerners, of course, are also too busy and too wealthy and too much given to mental activity, are particularly liable to lung illness. I'm sure you've run into that one. So, given time limitations, this will have to suffice. In fact, how am I doing for time? Because we started a bit. Yeah, okay. Yeah, never mind. Well, I'll keep going. So, given time limitations, this will have to suffice to give a picture of the kind of ways in which lung disease occurs and has been analysed. And it's probably obvious that we've also got somewhat different sorts of analysis here. Jane's frame of reference is primarily social and anthropological. Jacobson's more psychiatric. Prost is more concerned in the sort of micropolitics of the diagnosis of her ambitious young cleric, and the various other people we've written from somewhat different viewpoints. Though I think there isn't really yet a comprehensive Western study of lung. It would be good if somebody could do something substantial here, because it's clearly an important category. But so far we've been talking about what lung does as a pathogenic factor in illness. And when we move to lung in the tantric context, we come across a more complex explanatory structure, but one that intersects with the medical version of lung in a variety of ways. Now, leave that for a moment. Lung, as I've already mentioned, flows through the body, and we've already met the idea of the five principal forms of lung and their functions in the body, and this recurs in the tantric context. But tantric theory and practice is more concerned with the flow of lung as something to be transformed as a spiritual technique. In the tantric context, the flow of lung takes place through a structure of channels. I'm sure you've all seen diagrams like that. That's actually a Shaiva one, which is the one that's easiest to find off the internet when I put this together. But in fact, it's the same structure of the central channel and two channels winding around it, which is the central structure, though it's by no means all of the tantric physiology of Lung. There are lots of secondary channels going off in different directions. And at the point where these intersect, or at least actually in between them, are the famous chakras, which I'm sure you've all come across, Kola wheels in Tibetan, that have become a familiar staple of Western New Age thought. The three main channels are the central one and the two that go around it. And in the ordinary unenlightened, unawakened human being, there are kind of knots or obstructions at the point where these meet, which block the free flow of Lung within the channel. Now, the details get more complex if you start looking at different Tibetan tantric traditions. They're all somewhat different in detail. There are disagreements about the exact form of the channels, whether they work the same way in men and women, or whether they're left to right reversed, and how widely they go out or wrapped around the central channel, and so on. There are differences regarding how you fit the root winds, which we talked about before, the five pranas into the pattern, and so on, and how that relates to the process of achieving Buddhahood. And there are also disagreements about the degree to which the Lung have material existence, particularly at the coarse level of ordinary perception. Tibetan doctors in particular, and many Tibetan tantric practitioners and scholars, were also trained in medicine, so there's an overlap between these groups of people, were well aware that the channels and chakras could not be identified in any straightforward way with the physical body. If you do an autopsy and cut a body open, you can't find the tantric channels and the chakras. They came to that conclusion fairly early on. Some of you may know the work of the Harvard Tibetanist scholar Janet Gatso, in whose recent book Being Human in a Buddhist World, the disagreements between Tibetan medical scholars regarding the real existence of the channels plays quite an important role. It's a very interesting analysis. I've got some doubts about it, in part because I feel that Tibetan medicine really can't do without the spiritual dimension, and this picture that she draws of a kind of secular scholars who are fighting with the lamas who keep trying to drag them back into all this tantric stuff, I think is a little exaggerated. But at any rate, I think that this is not a totally straightforward or uncontroversial set of concepts within Tibetan thought. It's something that's argued about, discussed, theorized, and so on. But certainly the Tibetan partner in in today's dialogue, as I said, our slightly imaginary Tibetan talking to our slightly imaginary Westerner, accepts the existence of the chakras, if not at a physiological level. What is important to note, though, is that the Lung are directly associated both with the process of rebirth and with the attainment of Buddhahood, awakening, enlightenment, whatever, which in the Buddhist scheme of things is the opposite of rebirth. This is often described in terms of contrast between karmic Lung and wisdom Lung. Karmic Lung that's linked to karma, to the process of past action, caused by past action, brings about rebirth. It drives the ongoing process of samsaric life. As Elio Gorisco puts it, the karmic wind is inseparable from thoughts and emotions. The karmic wind is the mount for the 18 natural concepts. This is back to the horse and rider image, including attachment, anger, ignorance, and so on. These conceptions manifest during the life of the individual and are like a pattern or cage in which the individual is trapped. Quote's actually there. So the aim of tantric yoga really is to transform the karmic Lung that flows in the outer channels into the wisdom Lung, which is the cause of Buddhahood. This is one way of describing the process. And tantric yoga, which involves a combination of visualization, chanting of mantras, physical movements, breathing practice, and so on, is all about learning to control these processes and as a mechanism for the achievement of enlightenment. And this is really the centre of what meditation means in most Tibetan traditions. Later in the same chapter of the book of Gorisco's, he quotes the late, very well-known Tibetan Lama Dinga Tenzi Rinpoche, who's widely recognized as one of the great tantric masters of the 20th century, saying, in fact, the wisdom wind and the karmic wind are the same thing. If it's brought under control, it engenders wisdom. If it's not controlled, it gives rise to the ordinary mind together with its poisons. That's the most important thing at the perfection stage of tantric practice, the second two major stages, is to work effectively on the wind and so on. And then there's the essence drop, the tigle, which is also linked to the mind. But you can get the general idea here without going into the details, which is that the need to control lung is at the centre of the tantric process. And it's essentially how you do it, how you achieve enlightenment for the Tibetans. I could say a lot more about this, but I won't. What I really wanted to do was just give a general picture of this side of the role of lung. But we can sum up by saying, in relation to lung and tantra, that meditation-caused illness is a familiar concept in tantric circles. It's normally associated with lung imbalance. And you can imagine if what you're doing most of the time is trying to manipulate these processes within the body, that when things go wrong, that becomes both a kind of general explanatory framework and something that you're quite concerned about. There are ways of dealing with these disorders through further lung practices, and you know, you can counter things going wrong in certain ways. But lamas can also just say to somebody, look, you better stop meditating, you know, eat some good solid food, go out and live an ordinary life. You're not suited for the hermitage or whatever. At least not till you get back under control. So that's one important context of lung illness. And lung in Tibetan thought, so in a way it does two things, and I think the relationship between them is quite interesting. And people have said somewhat similar things about Ayurveda too, which is that it provides a theory of optimum health, which here is the proper flow of the lung, leading to the minimization of karmic winds, destructive emotions. And it also provides a theory of things going wrong, of lung disorders, which correspond in many cases to the Western category of psychiatric disorders. And one thing that people have commented on sometimes is the lack of a real conception of positive health within Western society. And this is a tradition where that's actually very much where things come from, and which is the counter to the things that go wrong. Okay. So now I'll talk considerably more briefly, I hope, about Western ideas about the autonomic nervous system, which have played an important part in the developing Western understanding of Asian meditation techniques. And there are two stages to this argument. The first is to look at ways in which the Western understanding of meditation has moved towards a position with some intriguing and perhaps significant similarities to the Tibetan models I've been sketching so far. And the second, which is the conclusion really, is to make some observation about the distances that remain between Tibetan and Western understandings. Is there some real common ground here, or are there fundamental incompatibilities? Now, much of the Western scientific understanding of meditation goes back to... I love that picture. one very influential figure, the American cardiologist Dr. Herbert Benson, and his work on the so-called relaxation response from the 1970s onwards. Now, Benson, again at Harvard, was initially not concerned actually with Buddhist meditation, but with transcendental meditation, a Hindu-derived mantra practice that some of you may be old enough to recall. Well, actually, it's still around if you want to find it. It was popular in the 1960s and 70s. But he rapidly came to see TM not as a unique practice, but as one of a variety of cultural techniques intended to bring about this physiological response within the human organism, the relaxation response. And this created the dominant framework for viewing meditation for many years, both by scientists and by the lay population. And I think many people still assume that meditation, particularly in the lay population, assume that meditation is primarily a technique for relaxation and stress reduction. And this was also the framework within which Buddhist meditation and the new adapted practices such as mindfulness-based stress reduction were mostly seen. Now, Benson's relaxation response is based on a specific understanding of the autonomic nervous system. The line of argument here goes back to the work of the American physiologist Walter Bradford Cannon in the 1920s. This is obviously a very simplified and quick run through, but there you are. And Cannon developed the idea of the fight-or-flight response, you know, that animals respond to a situation of danger through activation of the sympathetic nervous system, which involves signals to the endocrine system and production of adrenaline and cortisol, and organisms prepared to fight or to escape or run away or whatever. And this was then picked up and developed by the Hungarian-Canadian endocrinologist Hans Sellier, right here in Montreal. He was actually at McGill for a while, and later on at Université de Montréal. Into a general theory of stress, which increasingly became applied to human beings as well as other animals. He mostly worked on mice, I think, but anyway, it seemed to be fairly easy to generalise from mice to human beings. And one of the things that happened in the process of the generalisation, though, which I think is quite significant, is the assimilation of psychological stress, which isn't something that had really existed before Sellier invented it, I think, with physical stress into a single mechanism. There was a general adaptive response to stress in Sellier's picture. In fact, our modern idea of stress, and we all know about stress, of course, these days, but it largely goes back to this highly creative, somewhat problematic guy, Hans Sellier, in the 1950s and 60s. And part of the package here is the idea that too much stress is not good for you. You don't want your sympathetic nervous system in a constant state of stimulation. However, in the 1940s, the Swiss physiologist Walter Rudolf Hess identified a second and alternative response to stress. I think this was something to do with the fact that he was working on cats rather than mice. And as you know, cats are wrong. If you put a cat under stress, it's likely to curl up and just ignore you or something rather than do what you're trying to make it do. Well, this was what, at any rate, Hess identified the trophotropic response, which involves the parasympathetic nervous system, not the sympathetic nervous system, and involves calming down the system rather than going into a state of arousal. And this became the basis of Benson's approach. Benson saw meditation as a cultural technique for achieving this. And just for those of you who this is a sort of diagram which you'll find versions of in most physiology textbooks, I think. And here you can see the sympathetic nervous system, which is, and the fight or flight response on one side, and the parasympathetic nervous system on the other side, and a set of things that they do within the body as a result of their activation. So what we're saying is that rather than that meditation takes you off, stops you from getting caught up on that side and gives you a chance to relax on this side. How far they separate as neatly as that is one of the questions I'm beginning to realise is not straightforward, but still. That's the same thing in a slightly different form. But do recall these two sides, and also recall those two channels which are rotating around the central channel in the tantric model. Okay. So Benson saw meditation as a cultural technique for achieving the relaxation response, and this became the dominant mode of understanding what meditation was about, as well as the basis for starting up an entire tradition of what's now often known as mind-body medicine, which is the name of his institute at Harvard. And so, for example, mindfulness-based stress reduction, the stress reduction part of the name is not at all coincidental. Kabat-Zinn's original context at the University of Massachusetts Medical School was a stress reduction clinic, and so on. Now, from the Buddhist point of view, there's a slight problem here, which is Buddhist tradition does not see meditation, bhavana or similar terms, as being primarily about relaxation or stress reduction at all. Instead, it sees it as part of a path leading to liberation from samsara, to Buddhahood. Precisely how Buddhahood is understood varies between traditions, but the key image is certainly one of awakening, awareness, responsiveness, not passivity and withdrawal. So this didn't bother the developing scientific consensus very much, since the scientists involved tended to see meditation in terms of a set of techniques that could be readily detached from their cultural context and from the ways in which they're traditionally understood. But by about 10 or 15 years ago, as the mindfulness-based and other meditation-derived approaches started to acquire the massive presence in our society that they've now reached, there began to be a whole series of studies that questioned in various ways the emphasis on stress reduction as the core of what meditation was about. Some of these, such as the Lutz and Davidson, etc. articles that are listed at the top of there, were pointing to elements of attention and focus that appeared to be central to the understanding of meditation in Buddhism, primarily. But others, like the article by Willoughby Britton and Gerard Lindahl, who Lawrence mentioned earlier, suggested that relaxation was not necessarily antithetical to awareness, and they suggested that there was a specific kind of awareness, or phasic awareness, that was associated with the activation of the parasympathetic nervous system. But at any rate, awakening is not a metaphor, is a fairly paper which was, I think, meant as a bit of a kind of call to action and to thinking about just how this, what this whole stress and relaxation was implying. And then the two papers by Maria Kozhevnikov and Ido Amihai were part of a systematic comparison between two forms of Theravadin meditation and two forms of Tibetan meditation, which demonstrated experimentally that much meditation clearly did involve states of arousal involving activation of the sympathetic nervous system. And this seemed to be true for both of the forms of Tibetan meditation she was looking at. So Lidke, the last of these people, actually are working on the Shaiva tradition, not the Buddhist tradition, argues that in a somewhat similar way to what I was saying about Tibetan meditation, that Shaiva meditation is a process of training, but here he quite explicitly says of the autonomic nervous system. So he's making the equation between the Shaiva equivalent of the system of prana and the autonomic nervous system. And this is something which, in fact, has been around for a little while. But to stay with Lidke for a moment, this training involves a balancing of sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, he suggests, in order to harness the potential that comes from a simultaneous activation of these deeply integrated neurological systems. And Maria Kozhevnikov and a couple of other people have been arguing similar things in recent years. So the idea that these practices involving the chakras and nadis, the wheels and channels within the body, through which subtle substances flow, can be seen as a kind of training of the autonomic nervous system, had actually been around for a while. I was quite interested in this because I'd actually been talking about it in some of my own previous writings, and I listed a couple of references there. And I was taking this from Alex Comfort's Eye and That, which is a very intriguing, fascinating book, if anybody's come across it, in which he speculates quite a bit about his own experience of tantric yoga. And more recently, some of you may have come across the work of Joe Loizzo in New York. That article, like the other things of his I read, tends to be a bit, I was going to say a bit fundamentalist about his reading of the tantric text. So he tends to treat this, you know, this is revealed truth almost. And whereas I think one needs to take a slightly more relaxed approach perhaps to how one understands this material. But nevertheless, it's a very interesting article, and he's been working in this area for some years. So this idea is around. But myself, I'd say that I don't think we have to take Tibetan accounts of the subtle body as literal physiological descriptions. I think we can see visualizing and learning to operate with the subtle body much more as a kind of constructive process than as a descriptive one. And after all, its intention is to bring about an inner transformation. I mean, this is something I've tried to spell out a bit elsewhere. But what I want to do here, though, is to talk a little finally about what this convergence of Tibetan Western ideas, if there is a convergence here, might mean. One thing I just wanted to add there is that if one can see a convergence of Tibetan Western ideas in relation to meditation in terms of the achievement of high levels of performance, health and balance, one can perhaps also see a similar convergence in terms of ideas of states of imbalance and of disorders. And there are long-standing suggestions that pathologies of the functioning of the nervous system might underlie psychiatric illness. And here I'm probably on shaky ground, but still. I've quoted, two bodies of work, really. There are Carol Izard and various people in the 1970s talking about emotion in terms of patterning of the central nervous system, the patterns of activation of the central nervous system. And more recently, there seems to be quite a substantial literature developing about disorders of the central nervous system in relation to autism spectrum disorders. And there's other stuff of this kind, right? Those are just two papers that are kind of there as a sample. So at this level too, the disorder side of the Tibetan pattern, there seems to be a possibility of connection. So here we have a potential area of compatibility between Tibetan and Western modes of scholarly and scientific understanding, both at the level of practices and at the level of theory. But before assuming a genuine relationship between the two sides, I think it's worth spelling out some of the similarities and differences, and that's what I'm going to do in this last concluding section. Similarities. One can certainly make a parallel between between the two aspects of the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic, and the two outer channels of subtle body practice. And I think if one can spell this out in considerably more detail if you look at what the various associations of the two channels. And one can also talk, if one follow on the Tibetan side, if one I've kind of already equated the two a bit there. The process of meditation is bringing the system of lung flows, of prana, to a high level of functioning, and possibly the question of tuning, adjusting the autonomic nervous system so that it's functioning at a high level of performance. This is something that Kashevnikov really comes from, that sort of background of high performance and how you achieve it, is very interested in. To go back to the two channels here, I spell it out a bit. The sympathetic system is active, involved in outward movement and engagement with the external world. The parasympathetic system is inward-looking, involved in withdrawal from action and engagement. The two outer tantric channels encode a similar opposition, means and wisdom, the active, externally engaged, outward-looking, the inward-looking, involving insight rather than engagement, and so on. Again, this is simplifying considerably. You get the general idea. And again, we have this idea of disorders manifesting a psychiatric illness in both cases. And another thing which perhaps is rather interesting, considering that this is that the Tibetan language is very much one of fluids and flows, is the role of the endocrine system and of hormonal flows. And because after all, the autonomic nervous system, this is also quite directly connected to a system of flows of various kinds. And again, I'm not suggesting an exact mapping of any kind, but it's an interesting parallel. However, there are also some very real differences. One difference, I think, is that the Western model here is one that operates primarily in terms of physiological variables, and it generally leaves consciousness out of the picture. Now, of course, when you talk about fight or flight or something, there is a certain amount of subjective identification going on perhaps already in that model. But nevertheless, the model is not really one of consciousness. It's one of the body. There are other Western models and approaches, psychoanalytic thought or whatever, that do operate in terms of consciousness, but that don't seem to be very easy to fit together with this. The Tibetan mode of analysis is posed at this level somewhere between mind and body, and these subtle levels of lung where things kind of fit together and connect mind and body. It's not purely material, it's not purely at the level of consciousness. Do these really equate? And again, the Tibetan mode implies the presence of karma as a causal force behind the operation of the flows in the subtle body. How seriously do we take this? Because, of course, it implies rebirth and continuity between consciousness and successive lives, which has always been one of the major sticking points between Western science and Buddhist thought. It comes up in quite interesting ways in the Mind and Life Dialogues, for instance. I've written about that elsewhere. And again, to look at further differences, the scientific mode tends to assume that it's dealing with empirical reality. I think when you read the Tibetan material, it often sounds much more metaphorical. Mind is riding the horse of the prana, this kind of thing. I'm not sure how serious this is. I mean, how far one can tie these things down, but treat them more, because of course there are a lot of solidified metaphors in Western thought too, including in scientific thought. But nevertheless, there's a different mode of discourse here, and one that perhaps is not that easy to equate. Yet I think we are left with the question of how far do quantities such as Lung really relate to an organic basis? And after all, remember, this is an organic basis, to go back to our Tibetan yogi, that can dissolve into the elements, leaving the residue behind. What does that mean about what kind of thing it is? I mean, and in a way, I'm just trying to start working through what are the points where there are real contradictions and real differences. Can one bridge them? Can one make links between them? What kind of process is this that one's engaging in? And if you were all kind of waiting for a nice tidy answer to this, I'm afraid you probably guess you're not going to get one. And anyway, I've probably been talking for long enough. So that's pretty much where this ends, except with that last question, which I think is always a question for medicine and of all kinds, which is, how far does it matter if it works?